and Land Revitalization, who will give us some opening remarks. Dave?
Hey, thank you very much, and also thank you, Michael, and any other presenters. I want to welcome everybody to this kickoff sort of session on real estate training. We did this a number of years ago, and we realized recently that it was time to do it again, because this is really a joint effort among headquarters staff, our regional staff, our state and tribal partners, and frankly, the communities that we provide funding for. Brownfields, at least in some level, is about real estate development. And it's brownfields, the engine that moves it is the desire for real estate, the need for real estate, and that helps this land recycling program. So we're really excited about it. We're doing this in part to support the Superfund Task Force, which has a list, many recommendations. One is to just expand knowledge among EPA staff about the basic elements of land of real estate development and what's needed to get a project going. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Amy Storm, and thank you, Amy, for organizing this webinar.
Thanks, Dave. Hi, everyone. I'm so glad you could join us today for this, our first webinar in the EPA Redevelopment Academy. Special welcome to all of our EPA staff who are joining us across so many different programs, cleanup programs in other parts of the agency, and then also our state and tribal partners. We're really thrilled that you could be here to join. And we know that there's a lot of folks participating in groups and conference rooms and such, which is excellent. We want this information to really get out there and to, you know, for these to be things that you start talking about with your colleagues. So as Dave said, you know, this training is designed to give all of us the opportunity to understand what the real estate development process looks like through the eyes of a developer. Here at EPA and in our state and tribal programs, we spend a lot of time talking about how to integrate cleanup and reuse and come up with sustainable approaches for the long-term protectiveness of the site. And this is a direct tie to that, you know, getting sites into reuse and thinking about how that reuse is compatible with the remedy. You know, a lot of it comes back to that. So we're really excited to talk about what the developer sees when looking at contaminated property and how to deal with that. I want to give you just a few remarks about how we design this training. So we have a series of three webinars, a mini-series, if you will, on real estate development. So this is the first one. The next one is at the end of this month on May 30th, and then there's one on June 5th. Those three webinars all go together. They're designed to build from each other. They're not repeat of information. The fourth element of the training is a half-day workshop, and this is a really hands-on, practical application of the information that you're learning during the webinars. It's not a repeat of the webinars at all. It's primarily group exercises, case studies, where you can work together with your colleagues and go through some case studies, go through a pro forma, really think about how do the environmental conditions of a property affect the deal. So we're going to talk more about that, but I just want to make clear that you attend the three webinars and plan to attend a workshop. And then we are going to be offering the workshop a few different times. You've probably all seen we're going to have our first workshop in Region 7 on June 7th. The next one is going to be on June 28th in Region 3. That's one that we're going to live stream so that folks who are want to participate remotely will be able to. We are also, breaking news, we're going to be offering two more workshops, one in EPA Region 9 on July 18th and one here at EPA headquarters on July 25th. And so we'll be getting that information out to everybody so you can decide what's the most appropriate one for you to participate in. For those who are interested in the live stream, we'll talk more about how that's going to work later, but we'll basically have somebody who's working in your office be designated as the point of contact to handle all the logistics. As far as your participation today, I think Abe already mentioned it. Please use the Q&A box. We'll look at questions as they come in. We also have a bunch of poll questions, which actually, Abe, can you pull up the first couple of poll questions? I'll get to know your audience kind of poll questions. So we'd love to know who's all here with us. And then we do want you to register your participation in the webinars and the workshops. And if you do that, you'll get, and you complete all three webinars and the workshop, you'll get a certificate of your participation. And so you'll do that by going on to the, confirming your attendance for the webinar by filling out the feedback form that Abe showed you already. Maybe at the end of the webinar we can pull that back up. So those are all my intros. Poll questions. So first poll question is up. So we're trying to find out, who do you work for? We've got, we're broadcasting the results of UC. So it looks like a lot of folks from EPA region, a lot of folks from the states, awesome. A few tribal members and folks from EPA headquarters. And again, we know that there's a lot of people, like here in my office, who are participating in a group. So this is excellent. Okay, let's give this one just another, like, 5 seconds, and then we'll move to the next one. Okay, cool. The next one is, what federal, state, or tribal program do you work for? And our apologies if we missed the key one. Okay, we'll give this one about 10 more seconds. Everyone's weighing in. Great participation. Okay. Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Okay, and then our third question is, what area do you work in? What area of the country do you serve? Okay. While we're finishing up that third poll question, I just want to give a little bit of intro about our instructors from Vita Nova. Our instructors, Mike Taylor and Elaine Richardson and Tony Bilecki, they are actually the folks who've worked with us years and years ago when, as Dave said, the EPA real estate development training first happened. By our count, we think it was about 8 or 10 years ago, and this was a kind of 2-day in-person class, which really brought folks from all different parts of the agency together to talk about real estate development. And so this time, in order to be able to reach so many more people, we're doing it webinar style with this plus the half-day workshop. But our instructors in particular wanted to make sure that folks here on the phone know, and I know that they'll reinforce this, that, you know, they are available as questions come up after the webinar. If something comes up and you just need a little bit more clarification, they are available to help with that, because we do want folks on this training to, you're not going to learn everything through these webinars, but we want you to walk away with a good foundation of the real estate development process. So I want to thank our instructors for making themselves available. And so, Mike, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I have to say that it's extremely gratifying that anyone remembers anything from 10 years ago, but the fact that you all remembered the training we did and have brought us back, it's very exciting. We did that over a 5-year period. We trained about 3,000 state and federal regulators. In fact, toward the end, the states were actually paying for us to come. So it's really exciting for us to be back. I'll tell you, we've learned a lot in 10 years. The markets have changed in 10 years. There's a lot of things going on. But we want to do this in a very stepwise fashion. We worked with Amy to create this academy, and we hope that, you know, there will be other opportunities in this real estate academy, but the three webinars, which I'm assuming will be recorded. So if your next door neighbor missed it, I think you can come back into Clue-In and watch it. And then the workshop all work together. So we'll be repeating things. We'll be talking about things more in depth. You're going to hear some things today that we do not expect you to necessarily know all about. We'll be coming back to talk more about some of those things, particularly finance. That'll be part of it that you'll hear more and more and more about. And we'll actually get to play with pro forma as developers. And that was the key to what we did 10 years ago was, you guys get to play developer in a half-day workshop as a team, go through case studies, select your redevelopment. So it's a lot of fun, and I guess that's the big point, is that the real estate industry is huge. It's trillions of dollars. Obviously, every town, there's somebody trying to do something in the real estate world. And so you just can't learn it all in three webinars and a workshop. But I think we have a way for you to sort of work your way into it. And quite frankly, my guess is there are some of you that are, you know, have a little thing going with your cousin on the side, or you've fixed up houses and sold them. So you have your own experience to bring to this. And so it's great to be with you. Today, Elaine Richardson is going to be the primary speaker. I'm the president of Vita Nova. Many of you know me working on land revitalization stuff around the country. Elaine has been in the real estate industry for 25 years. She's worked on both traditional real estate as well as some of these tough sites that we've worked on around the country. And she's actually going to walk you through a real case study today, which is very exciting. We've got a lot to cover, and I'm going to turn it over to her very quickly. The other person, and one of the things we wanted to do with these webinars and with the workshops, is to introduce you to some of the other people at Vita Nova who, if you don't know, Vita Nova is sort of made up of senior-level people who've maybe, you know, done something else with their career and then joined us to consult in communities around the country, and then younger folks. And Tony was the Deputy Director of Economic Development in New Haven for over 20 years. He's a licensed broker. He's been involved in all kinds of deals. If you've been to New Haven, you know they've seen a renaissance during that time. Lots and lots of redevelopment, tough neighborhoods, tough parts of town have been reinvigorated. So he can talk you through the wars in New Haven. You'll hear from other folks like that during these webinars. And so that's why I say, if you have a question, if you want to talk, pick up the phone. We know many of you and have worked with some of you. So feel free to contact us because we believe in what David and Amy are doing. It's not just, hey, they hired some guys and girls to come talk. We believe in the mission. So we're happy to talk to you guys at any time. I have a couple more slides, and I'm going to turn it right over to Elaine because, as I said, we have a lot to cover, and we've got two opportunities for you to ask questions today at the end of the regular presentation and then at the end of the case study. So we want to get to that and have plenty of time. One of the things you're going to hear is a lot of jargon. Don't be confused by it. Many, many times there are the same words that you would use in environmental stuff, but they actually mean something different in real estate. So due diligence means all kinds of due diligence, not just ASTM, the ASTM standard, or whatever the case may be. It's about, you know, the physical property. It's about title. It's all kinds of due diligence. So when we say it, it has a broader connotation. Same with feasibility analysis. We'll talk about that today. And then there are these little terms that real estate folks use, you know, deal killers. You know, what's a deal killer? Well, you know, you'll learn about that, right? And there are certain things that developers just walk away from or should, right? So I just told a very quick little story about that. When we were doing training in Tennessee, one of the Tennessee State folks said to us, well, you know, we told them there were buried drums. They just kept saying they had it. They understood they were going to do it. And, of course, the deal went sideways, right, because the developer bought it. And, you know, they didn't really say there were uncontrolled waste that hadn't been characterized. They just told them there were buried drums. Well, the developers didn't know. Oh, we'll just dig up some drums. No big deal. So there are these deal killers out there. And, of course, you know, we all know that no one should buy a site with buried drums that you don't know what's in them. But there are many other issues like that. So at any rate, you'll learn about this jargon through the course of the work of these webinars. And certainly feel free to ask us offline if there's something you don't get. Go ahead. So we've worked very hard to develop what we think is a very clear approach to sharing this information. If they're not up now, there will be some resources from the Urban Land Institute, which go into much more depth about real estate development. This particular course is going to be an overview of real estate development, and we'll touch on many of the issues that developers face with regard to environmental issues on site. So this is kind of the overall course. Then we get into market analysis in the second course and finance in the third course. And then, like I said, you get to be the developer at the workshop, which is going to be a great time. So next. So you know, there was a need to sort of articulate why is this important. Obviously, there are lots more reasons that you all can find. This little statement in red comes from Vita Nova. I don't know if David and Amy would agree with that, but we've been doing this. Vita Nova's in its 20th year. We sort of work between tough sites and communities and developers. So we're the facilitator. We get in there, nuclear sites, refineries, chemical plants, you know, tough communities across the Midwest, you know, urban neighborhoods, you name it, we go there and we try to figure out how to make this work. And we find that unless there's income on the property, unless somebody's really thought creatively about integrating cleanup and redevelopment, it's not sustainable. We work in the Superfund program. We have two of Mr. Pruitt's top 21 sites, and we're always pushing, you know, our clients, PRPs, the communities, the developers, you know, we got to do this right. We got to make it sustainable. And they don't hire us unless they do. We're not interested in just selling sites to anybody, in seeing them go off without a clear reuse vision. So, you know, will this help you? Will this course help you do your job to help that in whatever way or shape or form you touch these projects? We hope so. So, okay, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Elaine.
And, good afternoon.
Okay. Elaine, I've given the intro, but I just want to say that Elaine has been through many, many of these projects, and so I hope you enjoy hearing from her.
Thank you, Michael. We're going to start out really about talking about the redevelopment process, and specifically we want to talk about what developers look for and how they make their money. And that's important for you to understand as you're looking at properties and thinking about how it might be used in the future. Understanding the decision-making process that the developers go through can be pretty important. Every development goes through three stages. That is, of course, assuming it gets completed, and that's not always a given. As we'll learn about fatal flaws, many developments don't make it through each stage. But successful developments will make it through these three stages. In this academy, we're going to discuss all three stages because they each have their own risks and their rewards. But today, our emphasis is really going to be on pre-development because that's where most of the risk is. So each developer looks at pre-development, then they go through the development stage of actually building the development, marketing it, getting tenants, and then management and holding it. So are they going to hold that property or are they going to sell it? And all of that influences the decisions that they make. So as I said, we're going to focus on pre-development. And why are we going to do that? Well, understanding your role in the pre-development phase is critical, as developers often evaluate as many as 20 sites before moving on with a single one of them. So with a better understanding of the steps the developer goes through, you'll be better positioned to help remove impediments and help facilitate redevelopment. In the pre-development phase, developers are balancing risks and rewards. They're trying to determine how costly it will be and whether or not they will be successful. But they're also balancing time. Time kills all deals, and this is where they're trying to understand whether or not they can get a deal done within a particular time frame. It's also the point where most developers will walk away. You'll find that developers will start doing their feasibility study. Things won't look very comfortable to them, and so they'll move on to another site. So it's helpful to start by understanding who is the developer, because developer is really a loosely defined term. In fact, anyone or any company that brings value to a deal is really playing the role of a developer. It takes a lot of individual talent to be able to close a deal, and all of that talent needs to really be at the table for a deal to be successful. The equity person is the person that's coming in with cash. Usually cash is used to do the initial feasibility study. They're going to spend their own money to figure out whether or not this is something that can be done. We'll talk more about that later as we go through. The owner is, as we all know, the one who controls the site, and that may be in some cases a property owner. It may be a group of owners. PRP groups often own sites, and it could even be a municipality or an agency that has taken ownership of a site. You also need to have financing partners, investors, at the table. Somehow that development needs to get paid for, so just having an interested developer with a great idea who doesn't have money isn't going to get the job done. And finally, you need to know who the tenant or the user is, because ultimately an occupied building is a successful building and is a sustainable building. And so as I said, you really need to have all of these entities at the table because they are all bringing forms of money to the deal. Even if they're not all there, you want to ask the question as to where are the other players. So let's talk for a minute about the development team itself. You know, at the very beginning, when we're looking for ideas and we have the desire to develop a property, it may be owners and public agencies and real estate brokers that are in the conversation trying to attract interest to a property. But once you actually have an interested developer, they're going to engage other expertise, appraisers, market analysts, planners, engineers, and even environmental consultants, to help them determine the feasibility of a project. This is not an insignificant investment. When developers get frustrated about projects not going very far or going fast enough, part of it is because that's often their own personal cash that they're investing at this phase of the deal. Once a project has passed the feasibility analysis phase and you're into negotiating an actual deal, attorneys, lenders, and other financial investors, mortgage brokers all get involved, insurance brokers get involved, if there's environmental insurance or even other specialty insurance, all of them are at the table or in influencing the language of the deal, the terms of the deal, and whether or not the project goes forward. And finally, the entitlement phase, which can be fairly significant, especially in certain states and regions, needs a different combination of engineers and architects and other types of attorneys and land use consultants to get the permits and the approvals necessary to build the buildings. So when you think about this, a typical development team for a successful project may have 30 different consultants on the project with varying expertise, all charging fairly significant dollars to bring a project just to the construction phase. So let's talk a couple of minutes about who actually buys contaminated sites. I think most of you have probably heard about brownfields developers. It's kind of a loose term that is a catch-all phrase, if you will, for people that are in the industry. But in reality, there's several different specialists in the market, and it's helpful to understand what their specialty is because that also affects the type of properties that they might be attracted to and interested in developing. So many of you are familiar with liability transfer companies that actually take on the liabilities from PRPs or liabilities that of orphan sites. But in addition to those companies, which are fairly well known, you've got private equity purchasers. Those are usually groups of individuals that are using their own private equity, either personal cash or combined cash from other deals, to purchase properties and essentially flip the property, develop it, and flip it. You've got environmental contracting partnerships. It is a way to drive business to the environmental construction and contracting firms to purchase the properties and make it part of the deal that they do the cleanup. There's also specialty development companies and conversion specialists. Those are ones that are looking for adaptive reuse and focus on new ideas to recycling land and buildings. And finally, we don't want to ignore the local industrial developers. Those are typically developers that are in specific industrial businesses that need very defined types of land parcels or former industrial sites. And those also are entities that get involved in buying properties. And it's helpful to understand that because when you're out to market a property, it's good to understand the type of entities that you want to attract to the development. So how does a developer decide about an opportunity? Well, essentially, market is the key. If there's no market, developers often look elsewhere. But that doesn't mean that there aren't market opportunities in seemingly slow markets. You just have to look a little bit deeper to find certain things. What you want to really understand are the goals and objectives of the developers that may be interested in this property. What does the property have? And we're going to talk a lot about that in a few minutes, about how to identify the assets about a property that might attract developers. And also, what is the current zoning and information that is available for the property. I say this specifically because 70% of all real estate decisions are made before anyone even knows a developer is looking. Online, publicly available information is absolutely critical to ensuring that you attract developers. If the information is outdated, inaccurate, it can be a problem because you'd be driving away interest in parcels just because you haven't identified what it is that developers may be looking for. And we're hoping that you'll be able to answer some of those questions about the sites you're involved with after going through this webinar. So let's talk for a couple of minutes and talk about the different types of development and the different types of developers. You'll find that developers usually operate within a specific submarket, such as residential or industrial or mixed use. And even the large real estate market analysis companies that are out there and the real estate brokerage firms track data based upon these submarkets. But developers also specialize in the type of construction that they do, whether they're starting with land, whether they're going with high-rise vertical construction, or whether they're looking at adaptive reuse. Some developers will do all kinds, but often you find that developers will just focus on one. So if it's an ideal adaptive reuse project, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to spend time trying to attract land developers when you have a building you want to have reused. Developers all have sweet spots. They specialize for a reason. It's how they make their money. And they have typically found that they won't make money if they get too far off of the area that they specialize in. It's also how they get their financing. When investors finance a development project, they want to know that the developers are experienced and have a track record. So they're not usually comfortable with financing a project that a developer has never done before. So it's important that they stay within their sweet spots. Well, what are some of those types of sweet spots? One is speculative development, meaning that they're building a building in hopes that the market will come to them. That typically takes a lot of risk. It costs a lot more to do that. You don't get good financing for that type of development. What does get the best financing is build to suit, meaning you already have a tenant defined and identified and under contract for the building, and you're building that building specifically for them. And that's easy to quantify, and therefore it's easy to finance. And you've heard the term hold versus flip on a lot of the HGTV programs for homes. Are we going to flip a house? But understand that many developers make their money holding properties and serving as real estate management corporations. They charge money to manage properties and to serve in that role. And so understanding that that's where they're going to make their money is helpful as you evaluate different developers. So how do we go about attracting interest? Essentially, developers are always looking. They're always on the lookout. In many cases, they're looking harder in slow markets because they have more time. When it's a really busy market, they don't always have time to go look at the tough sites. So it's kind of counterintuitive to think that when the market isn't great, you can get more interest, but it's actually how we have found that it works. They do start with, as I stated earlier, the online databases. State and regional economic development listings, really, really helpful. They look there to see what's out there. Even if they're tough and contaminated sites, it's still important to put them out on those databases. It's where all developers start. Also, what we have found, and I know others, especially at the local and regional levels, have found is the use of expression of interest and request for proposal processes. It helps gauge the market interest. It also drives interest in the property because you're creating a competitive situation. You do lose some developers that aren't willing to respond to those expressions of interest, but quite frankly, if it's a really good site, they're going to come after it. So just be aware of that. There are ways that EPA and the states can and tribes can help support communities by encouraging these types of formal processes. I think you wanted to add a poll right now. And we're going to ask a little bit about what describes the real estate market in your area, whether or not it's hot or lukewarm. That'll give me a little bit of sense of what we have going on. It seems right now more are coming from hot markets. We are in a good time frame for development as compared to certainly 10 years ago. We all struggled through 2008 to about 2014. We've seen some greater activity in the last several years, and it seems like many areas of the country are seeing some of the same things. So how do developers make money? Well, they make money in different ways and in multiple ways, and this is really important to understand because oftentimes sites are brought to market too late, given how developers make money. Site repositioning and site development is pretty common that people think about that. But many developers make money off of decommissioning former industrial sites and scrap materials and metals. So they want the ability to shut down and take down former sites. It doesn't need to necessarily be shovel ready for all developers. Some developers want to be able to invest in construction services because they own the construction company. They can make money there. Maybe the profit on the development isn't very good, but they can make profit elsewhere. Same thing with remediation and long-term O&M. Remediation companies are buying properties on occasion. They look at it as an opportunity to make money because oftentimes the seller is helping to fund some of the remediation activities in addition to the opportunity to develop the site. And finally, property management is an entire revenue stream that developers use as part of their bottom line. And so they look at it as more of a 30-year management and not just what am I going to make on the development over the next 3 to 5 years. So just understanding the value is in the eye of the beholder, and be cautious not to to bring a property to market too late. That kind of gives you a little bit about who developers are, what their interest is. But once a developer's interested in a property, they're going to begin the feasibility analysis process. That's all about risk. It's risk different than what you may think of as risk. They think primarily monetary, liability, and timing. Those are the three key things. Risk means answering the questions, can this project be done, and can I make money doing it? And we're going to go through several slides to talk specifically about how a feasibility study is done. In evaluating the feasibility of a real estate development, developers look at a broad range of site features to identify potential flaws. And they want to evaluate numerous risks beyond environmental and determine whether or not they can make a profit. And they do that by weighing the opportunities and the constraints associated with each property. So throughout this webinar, I'm going to talk about a particular brownfields property that was recently successfully sold for redevelopment. And we're going to use this to demonstrate the process that developers go through and evaluate the feasibility of a property. We've changed a few of the details on this to protect the confidentiality of the seller and the buyer, but the process is the actual one that we went through, and it'll help demonstrate how the deal actually was successfully done. This is all important for you to understand the different risks that developers evaluate and how it differs from a traditional real estate development when there is environmental constraints associated with the property. So looking at the developer's feasibility analysis, the developer is going to look at a few things. They're going to look at the property itself. They're going to look at wetlands. They're going to look at floodplain. We'll talk a little bit about that. They're going to look, in this case, the fact that it's a waterfront property. It has some existing wharfs here. They have a water intake draw located here. The site, however, has some significant topographic issues. You can't really see them with all the buildings here, but what you need to know is this property is sloping towards the river, and that poses some additional challenges associated with redevelopment. The developer also evaluated here the neighbors around the property. There's residential in this area, more industrial sites down below the property, and then you've got a major highway here. All of these things played in to the developer's evaluation of whether or not they wanted to go forward. When we look at this drawing now, we see a couple of things here. We see some easement locations here and here. The properties have been used for decades. Oftentimes, older historic industrial properties have legal easements that encumber the property. In this case, easements existed for water, sewer, gas, and power that were placed on the deed and are located within the property. So they can't necessarily remove those without investing some significant legal efforts to do that. But they may have to work around in order to develop buildings where these easements are located. You'll also notice here I've got some areas of the site that are highlighted here. Those particular areas have deed notices as well, and those are because they are closed RCRA impoundments, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But looking at the deeds is an important part of evaluating properties. Go on to further look at the rail spurs that you can see here in black that have been added to the property. Many former industrial sites have on-site rail spurs. These spurs can be viewed as either an asset or a constraint, depending on the developer's potential future use, and most importantly, the ownership of those spurs. If the rail spurs are owned by the property owner, which is not always the case, then the property owner controls their use. However, if the spurs are owned by the railroad, permission must be obtained from the railroad before they can either be reused, moved, removed, changed in any way. And for those of you that have dealt with some of the railroads, that's not an insignificant investment of time and effort to get the railroads to work with you. Many other older industrial sites also have multiple buildings on the property. Whether they're usable or obsolete depends on their size and condition and also their location. And evaluating their condition and presence of asbestos and lead and other hazardous building materials is a significant out-of-pocket cost. And so you'll find that developers typically don't do that level of evaluation until they're sure that the property hasn't passed all the other feasibility issues and there's no fatal flaws. So again, looking at infrastructure are some of the things in terms of is the infrastructure capacity sufficient, and are the buildings of any value or are they obsolete? So why do I focus a little bit on the particular assets that I highlighted here over the last couple of slides? And that's because for certain types of uses, there are very particular assets that are helpful to already exist and are attractive to development. For instance, I'll talk about power generation that you see here in this particular chart. In power generation, developers look for a location, typically where there's heavy industrial, so they don't have a lot of pushback from the entitlement process. They like to be able to use some of the buildings on a property, if not for the actual development, often for ancillary uses like supplies. Rail can be very helpful depending on the type of power. Water supply is essential, and access to power grid is absolutely essential. Could also be access to natural gas if it's a natural gas power generation, but understanding all the assets that are in your mix on your property is helpful to understanding the type of land use that may be interested or feasible on the property going forward. So developers must also look at ownership records to determine if there's any unexpected constraints. And what do I mean by that? Well, for instance, some owners may have a side agreement that allows another party the right to lease a portion of the property into perpetuity or for a 99-year lease. That really impacts your ability to redevelop the site. But there's also other agreements that may be on the deeds or at the state or local level that give third parties the right to match an offer. The right of first refusal is the phrase. This can be extremely frustrating to a developer if they've invested significant money in evaluating a property and were not made aware of that information up front. So it's very important to understand, are there certain regulatory constraints on how a property may be sold or the process that may be used to sell it. So in addition to some of the other characteristics that we have to evaluate and developers evaluate on a site, we also look at ecological and environmental characteristics. For instance, in this particular property, we've got wetlands located in certain areas of the site. We've got floodplain that we have to work around. And as I mentioned earlier, we have some areas that have some land use restriction. Development in floodplain and wetland areas are not only regulated, but in many cases, developers cannot obtain financing or insurance for developments, even if they can get approvals to develop. Even projects such as solar are often uninsurable in a floodplain. So while we often think regulations dictate what can and can't be done, the financial and insurance markets have a huge influence on the type of efforts that redevelopment could be done on a property. In addition, other things that you need to be aware of is some states have further regulations defining development along coastal regions, high-quality habitats, and old-growth forests. All of that is something to be aware of. So in this feasibility analysis we've discussed so far occurs on every redevelopment, whether it's a contaminated property or a traditional development. But evaluating the environmental status is really unique when you're looking at historically industrial properties, known contaminated properties, or properties that are perceived and suspected to have contamination issues. So in addition to evaluating the property, developers will look at the environmental status, the regulatory programs. They want to understand who the lead agencies are, and really understand the short and long-term liabilities. Long-term liabilities are really critical to understanding whether or not your development can fulfill and meet the necessary revenues to be able to pay for those obligations. So when we look at the environmental status on our case study property here, this property has a long history of industrial use. However, prior to sale, it had been well characterized, and many of the RCRA solid waste management units had already been closed. However, the property does have land use restrictions and requirements for ongoing monitoring. So in this particular case, the land use restrictions are located on impoundments that have been closed over here, and there's ongoing requirements that must occur throughout the site in terms of monitoring and maintenance of groundwater wells. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about how this was actually brought to development. But what's important to understand and often overlooked by many sellers is that when a developer looks at the property with land use restriction, their valuation of the property will be limited to the areas available for redevelopment. So in this case, a developer may be willing to purchase the entire site, including those areas with land use restrictions, but they won't pay the owner for the acres that are restricted in use. So when we think about that, So when we think about that, this 120-acre parcel has approximately 20 acres of land areas constrained, and in addition, they have on-site rail spurs that they need to manage and challenges and opportunities associated with easements from utilities. And so all of that will play into the purchase price. So having finished the feasibility analysis and understanding the area available for redevelopment, developers will then proceed with a detailed market analysis. Our second webinar is going to focus entirely on markets, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But I want you to understand it is a very detailed analysis of market conditions and economic trends that developers perform before investing in a development. That development and that evaluation influences what their ultimate plan for the property will be, and ultimately they need to look at what they intend to do with it, because they have to weigh redevelopment costs with potential for sale, how quick that sale might be, or how they might also achieve profit in the short run through leasing the property. But when they're looking at the market, they will focus on the risk of the market, the risk of time, is the market opportunity a limited opportunity, and can they actually achieve what they're trying to achieve in that time frame. And Tony's going to talk a little bit more about how you go through the actual contract negotiation, but what happens at this phase, after they've tested the feasibility, they're going to look at all the things from land use regulations to areas available for redevelopment, and they're also going to evaluate the community's appetite. What is the likelihood for support, and that includes land getting actual entitlements, but also pushback. And so I'm going to turn this over to Tony, who's going to talk a little bit more about the fatal flaws that can haunt some of these properties.
Thank you, Elaine. So fatal flaws and deal killers. So what are the major problems that developers have to really look forward and understand what may come up down the line? So what you see on the slide here is each one is very important. They range from these everything from about the environmental condition of the site to the regulatory process, to what's called extraordinary deal costs, acquisition, zoning, construction costs, and even risky markets. So just taking a couple of them, the site cleanup. So not really knowing what the cleanup fully involves and not being able to identify costs and schedules creates a serious risk to a developer. So that's why comprehensive environmental assessments and solutions are crucial at this stage. They're also expensive because consultants, as we all know, tend to be expensive in terms of doing analysis and testing depending on the nature of the site. And tied to that is if there's an unclear regulatory process, it also means time and money. Some developers have a better understanding of state and federal procedures, but even they will have to engage environmental consultants and attorneys to work with them, again, at a cost. And then every situation and location is different. Some regions and cities may involve extraordinary labor and construction costs, and some real estate markets are hot, and population is growing, businesses are expanding, moving in, and there's a really strong demand for residential and commercial development. But many other regions and locales are risky to developers due to, you know, an unstable economy, or companies are closing, relocating out of the area, lost population, and often poorly run or understaffed local or county governments. So the developer has to have a really good sense of each of these items on the slide here. And question comes up, how can the EPA, state, and tribes help? Well, clearly having consistent process and decision making that's transparent and everybody is aware of or is easily accessible. Timely reviews, I think as Elaine mentioned earlier, time is really of the essence to developers, because it can really kill a deal. Prioritizing sites that are shovel ready or have a project ready to go, really need to be prioritized. And then providing resources for site characterization and cleanup through either grants or low interest loans or other types of incentives are need to be available and helpful for developers in certain situations. The next is several sides we're going to talk about are financial risk. And they begin to address the financial risk of development, including those properties with environmental issues. So all the risks highlighted on the slide are important. Some are more straightforward, like property taxes. So property taxes is there, and the question is, what will the property taxes be on a finished product? And usually a developer can look at similar projects in a municipality or county and use them to compare. But, you know, you could have a municipality that has a very aggressive tax assessor who thinks, well, the buildings are brand new and developers make lots of money, so suddenly the taxes are much higher than projected. So these are the kind of things where a developer really needs to understand what the taxes might be, but also being able to confer with a municipality and sort of getting some assurance of what those might be down the line. Or in the case of environmental costs, let's say you're the developer. Your environmental consultant has reviewed all the documents available from the seller or records on file with EPA or the state, or you've done your phase one, two, and even three assessments that you paid for as a developer. But somehow, in the process of taking down an existing building, the demolition contractor finds hidden behind the steel building frame and concrete walls is asbestos-laden waterproofing. And that has to be removed and trucked away and costs $250,000 now. So there's going to be a significant change order from the contractor that has to be approved. The entire schedule is thrown off, and there's lots of finger pointing going on and potential liability, professional liability issues as to who's responsible. But it does impact the project financing. And many times the developers protect it to a certain point, since all projects build in a contingency factor to deal with cost overruns. But the contingency must last all the way through the final construction and cover a lot of items. So the important point of this slide is to reduce the risk listed here. A developer must research and develop a clear understanding of every potential risk and feel comfortable with what those are going to cost going down the road. So financial feasibility. And what is a performance? So this is the stage in the development process. The developer and the investor identify and they commit to a lot of assumptions about the project, how much am I paying for the land? How many square feet of warehouse am I going to build? Or how many apartment units? How much does the cleanup cost? And at the same time, they must identify what the revenues will be from, say, renting or selling that warehouse or the housing units that are going to be built. So these assumptions and the numbers associated with them are put on paper. And one of the key documents that's used here is a pro forma. And that simply is a statement that identifies income and expenses in the project. And the question is, do the numbers work? Does the project, you know, produce enough income to pay expenses and make enough of a profit or return for an investor while at the same time being able to pay the mortgage or lenders back if you borrowed money? So these assumptions are what the developer literally takes to the bank or a pension fund or a municipality where they may be bidding on a piece of city-owned property. And their finance partners in the process will often be, depending on the reputation and experience of the developer, how successful are their other projects, did they build what they said at an approved cost, were they correct in estimating how much demand there will be for the apartments or warehouse space. And investors, and in many cases, state and federal programs participating in the funding of the development will be reviewing these performance. And one way to be sure that the numbers really do work, and also what is proposed, does that meet guidelines that the investor or government agency requires? So back of the envelope. So back of the envelope is a basic pro forma. It's one that developers basically do in their heads all the time or occasionally scratch out on a piece of paper. And what it is, it's a simple analysis looking at a property to be developed. They make certain assumptions about revenues that are expected minus expenses, and you use those numbers to see if a deal works with a few basic simple formulas. And if the numbers don't work, it's often said that a property is upside down. That is something that something in the proposed assumption, such as the price of purchasing the land, is too high, or the cost of cleanups too expensive, or the revenues are inadequate. And often in the case of like contaminated properties, the extra cost of doing a significant cleanup adds too much to the expense side. Well, down the street, you may have a similar but a clean piece of property that could work. So as you know, many of these legacy properties can sit empty for decades because the cleanup cost is just too high to make numbers work, or the seller will not lower the prices. So how can an upside-down property be developed? So not all upside-down properties can be redeveloped, at least not for some of the uses that people would like to see there. So we clearly know that residential properties don't usually work on a lot of older industrial properties. Because the cleanup cost is either near next to impossible or so prohibitively expensive, it just never makes sense. But you could build something else there, an industrial use, and use the land in a different way. But to make an upside-down property work, sometimes if there's a good project, communities behind it, everybody feels it's the right thing, clearly this is where federal, state, local incentives come into play. For instance, using brownfield grants, low-interest loans, or specific tax credits to make the numbers work. And there's other programs we know become very popular, such as transit-oriented development or affordable housing. So securing the deal. Okay, so assume the preliminary numbers work, and the project passed the basic test, at least on the surface, but there's still numerous steps to take to move the deal to the next step. The next step we can call contract negotiation, and in many ways it's similar to buying a house, and you and the seller agreeing to the terms that up to now have been informal and non-binding. So The next step is you negotiate a purchase and sales agreement that states that you have tentatively agreed on a sale price. You agree that you need to do a home inspection. You leave open that you may ask for repairs to be done and have the seller lower the price. And you likely indicate that you're seeking finance at a certain rate. You need a period of time to get that commitment from the bank. You'll need title searches, other property documentation, such as, you know, no lead, no asbestos, no abandoned oil tanks. And, of course, if any of those items get held up, the buyer asks an extension of time. So at this stage of commercial real estate development, it is similar to buying or selling a home. The issues are primarily between the buyer and the seller at this point, and they often have to compromise to make it work. So as in buying a house, these issues sometimes work themselves out, but often they don't. And at some point, either the buyer or the seller give up because months have gone by with no agreement. And again, time is important in the development process. So understanding the full financial picture. So this is a slide that we describe as a very simple performance that developers use at this stage. And these performance actually can be 30 or more pages. They usually run on some type of software that identifies the assumptions that go into the key line items, such as acquisition costs, hard and soft development costs, including remediation, carrying costs, and the revenues. So even though this, what's on this slide will clearly be covered, as Mike had said earlier on in the third session on real estate financing, what's important here at the moment is recognizing some sort of common sense factors that go into financing a deal that are presented here. And in this particular performer, the revenues include the sale of a rehab building and land sales of 50 acres. And in this case, the net profit is the total sale price of a project minus the total project cost. And it's worth noting that at the bottom, the simple annual return seems high and is not often that high. And the expected returns don't always materialize in every project. But these, every single one, which you see under Finance 101, will be discussed in great detail again in the third session. So contract negotiation. So at this stage of the development process, you enter into contract negotiation. Now, we already have a sales and purchase agreement in place with most of the key issues agreed to, the sale price, the financing, environmental approvals. But now, as we move to a closing, the deal has to get more specific with contractual language that spells out who in the deal is responsible for key issues and how they get done and when. So the idea is to reduce the risk of something going wrong along the way. Real estate lawyers for both the seller and the buyer of property are always involved at this point as they're crafting the contract to, in one sense, protect their clients. But the final product really is a contract that guides and safeguards the project as it moves forward. In the contract, all the topics listed on the slide under risk management are defined, and also when certain actions will take place as the property is transferred. So if you take transferring liabilities from the list there, on properties that have existing regulatory orders and permits, the contract will identify those orders and permits and clearly state who's assuming them, what agencies must approve the transfer, and at what point in time that must happen. So an example is if the property has an ongoing water treatment and monitoring in place. And let's say the seller is passing that responsibility on to the developer. So language in the contract will be very specific about the orders, the permits that regulate the groundwater, and who will be responsible going into the future. And at the same time, if the regulatory agency requires that financial assurances are in place, to maintain the system for the next 10 or 20 years, that will be in the contract. This gets us to the, what we call a formal commitment in closing.
Hey, Tony, I wanted to make a comment on this because this is a, real quick before you move on. This is a real key point for those of you that are involved in the decision-making process on site. So if you're negotiating a remediation agreement or you're dealing with parties that have permits, the way to build a risk transfer, which is on any contaminated site, we would call it a risk transfer of some form, whether the seller is going to keep some of that risk or the buyer is going to take all of that risk, always they build upon what you do. So you're knowing that a deal is going to occur, you're knowing, you know, who the parties are, you're knowing how the deal is going to be structured with regard to who's taking on what responsibility. That's not a bad thing, because in all cases, insurance is great, and there's been a lot of talk about insurance, et cetera, et cetera. But really, risk transfers are built upon the regulatory systems in the state and federal government controlling contamination and remediation. So this is where we start, and then we add other things to ensure that there are no problems down the line. So anyway, Tony, keep going.
Yep. So formal commitment and closing. So at the final stage of development, before closing on the property, there are still questions and some risks, despite all the due diligence that the developer and investors have taken. And the deal isn't really done until the developer has site control and prepares for environmental cleanup and construction. On many projects, a significant portion of the funds at the early stage, during market analysis, environmental assessments, or obtaining zoning relief, they come from the developer or boutique investors who have a relationship with the developer. As one gets to closing, all the financing must be in place, and depending on the source of the financing, both pension funds and banks and other investors, they've attempted to structure the financing in a way that ensures the developer can complete the acquisition, cleanup, and construction. In addition to pension funds and banks, the EPA, state environmental agencies, and municipalities often provide cleanup grants or other financial incentives to a project, and they all have degrees of oversight of the project, including accounting for expenditures and scheduled disbursements based on agreements that the parties have all signed off on. And in the case of a developer defaults or cannot finish a project, the investor or bank will step in at the last resort, but usually reluctantly, and often involves some type of either workout with the developer or sale of the property. And at this point, before we go to questions, Elaine or Mike, do you want to add anything else?
Yeah, so I think the only thing that I would add, but we did want to take a break here, and before we get into the case study, so we've got case studies throughout the webinars, and then you're going to get to work on one. I did want to say that the banks may not be at the table when these sites close. So if the cleanup has not occurred, it's we have found that institutional money is not available. So the money that's getting these deals done is private equity investors who are willing to take more of a risk or very sophisticated with regard to environmental issues and regulations. But essentially, they're putting up their own money to get things done. Until the cleanup is done, they have a tenant, something along that line. So we'll talk in the future about various money timelines where different money is involved to get to the getting the deal done. But getting that cleanup sign-off from you can be a huge milestone for them, because that means they can take their money out, they can put institutional money in, and that'll allow them to build and grow out the development, et cetera. Elaine, did you want to say anything before we open it up for questions?
No, I think we're ready for questions, and then we'll get into the case study.
Great.
Hi, this is Amy. Thank you, Tony and Elaine and Michael. We did have a few questions come through that I'm going to pitch to you guys. So the first one was that came through was with Elaine when you were talking about the types of people who buy contaminated sites, the types of companies. The question that we got was, are these types of people who buy contaminated sites also the same types that you would see in a small and rural area?
Elaine, do you want me to cover that?
You can start it, and I'll add.
Yeah. So next week, we're going to, I think, in the next webinar, we're going to talk about first, second, third, and fourth tier markets. And it's a loosely defined way for the real estate market to kind of break out demand in various areas. And small towns and rural areas many times don't have developers, right? So they'll have local business owners, they'll have construction companies, they'll have local investors and local people who care about their community, et cetera, et cetera. But they won't have the traditional kind of developer who comes in and makes money specifically on getting the development done. So the kind of people you'll see are ones that want to build something because they want to own it and use it or lease it, but not your traditional developer. Now, part of what we do, and we have the Lorain Area-Wide Planning Expression of Interest on the street, so go to Lorain Harbor AWP, is try to attract developers to second, third, and fourth tier communities, and they will come. And we have had success in doing it, but it's sharing the opportunity, it's sharing the assets, and helping people see what they might not see on their own. Elaine?
Yeah, I think that's the important thing. We ran an expression of interest process for a project in a very rural community, had 70 residents in the town, and it was hard to get to, but it had very specific assets that were attractive to the energy market, to the forestry market, and believe it or not, to the institutional market. There's a number of institutional markets out there, such as large universities and pension funds that want to have certain types of properties in their portfolio. And so you can attract them. It's just a little bit harder, and it is a subset of those that you saw in that list that will be attracted to that type of location.
Great. Thanks, you guys. We have had a few more questions come in, so I want to get to those. So here was a question related to the power grid example, Elaine, that you gave. When we were looking at the power grid and access to transportation and those kinds of assets, to what extent did developers look at the local community as an asset or a constraint? And if so, what specifically are they looking for?
Well, that's actually a great question, and we'll spend a lot of time in that a little in the market portion of the work. But I think the first answer is workforce really matters to certain types of uses, and so developers that are focusing on certain types of uses are going to look at that closely. They're also going to look a little bit at community activism. There are two sides to every coin, and the issue with having a very active community is, on the positive side, is you know what the community wants, and on the negative side, it will detract certain developers that don't want to go into a community with an idea that they think that's going to get pushback on. But there are an equal number of developers who like to go into community with a very clear idea in terms of what the community is looking for. So it can be helpful to have a very active community, but workforce and demographics are important. Demographics plays a significant role in retail. Retail is very focused on targeting sub-markets of demographics, and so those are some of the things we'll talk about when we talk more about market.
Cool. Okay. Folks are probably noticing we had a few poll questions that were just going to pop up during this Q&A part, so feel free to answer and let us know what you think. A couple more questions, and then Mike and Elaine and Tony, tell me when you need to move on to cover, have enough time for the case. So let's see. One of the questions that came in was regarding the environmental status and the extent to which developers would rely on, say, EPA or state agencies for reliable data about the environmental conditions of the property. So do you have any thoughts about, you know, to what degree developers come to EPA or states looking for that information?
So in a private transaction, it will be done under confidentiality, and it's likely that the owner, if they're a responsible party, will not want the developer to talk to the agencies until a deal is struck. And then, as Tony said, you know, you sign a purchase and sale agreement, but then there may be a sub-agreement or, you know, the final terms are worked out for closing. So once you get to that, then you got to share everything. So you can go talk to the state agencies. They, you know, can do whatever. But I would say when there's an abandoned site or community-owned site, you know, you see developers coming to the state and feds much more often than if it's a private transaction. We run these data rooms where we put up all the important documents and make sure, and it's, you know, for us, it's about disclosure. We want them to know everything, but there is a hesitancy to talk to or interview the regulator until or unless they're really in a deal.
Great. Thanks, Mike. So another question that came in was, we've talked about, you know, contamination and liability kind of from the environmental perspective, but a question came in about are there concerns in the real estate world about liabilities associated with contamination from a variety of drug uses, such as fentanyl and other types of things. So, thoughts on drug use contamination at properties and how that's managed?
We have not run into that. Tony, have you run into that?
Not that much, no.
No.
I you know, it sounds like an emerging issue. We have not run into that in the sites that we're working on, but I would suggest that there is always, you know, is there something else that either might be regulated in the future or something unknown? And that's, we're not going to talk a whole lot about insurance in this course. You know, it could be for a later version of this academy, et cetera, but there is insurance for unknowns. And for a developer generally, unless they know it's there and, you know, need to work through it, that's where you would put those things that are not known, that you don't know what the regulatory status is. You would buy that environmental insurance, and that kind of protects them, or at least there's somebody to look to if there is a problem later on. But we haven't run into it yet, not to say that we won't.
Okay,
and so we should move on if you have one more question, and then we'll have time at the end for more questions.
There were a couple more questions, but we'll hang on to them. I just wanted to see if you guys could comment very briefly on the poll that we have up right here in terms of we asked folks what community situation tends to work best for a developer. Overwhelmingly, people said that what they really think works best is if there's a general idea of what they would like the community would like to see happen at a site. So do you have any thoughts on?
You know, I think I'll start by saying that having a general idea is much better than having a complete and clear-cut vision, unless the clear-cut vision is market-based. Essentially, if an idea that a community has is not supported by the market, it doesn't matter how supportive the community is of that idea, because a developer can't make money. They've got to be able to see a way to pay for it and to come out whole and have it worthwhile for them to come in. So having a general idea is a good thing. Knowing exactly what they don't want is also a good thing, because developers won't waste any money. But it's when they're totally stuck on a particular vision, and that vision isn't supported by the market, that can be the most difficult for communities, because you know, they kind of get that idea in their head.
Tony, do you want to comment on that? I'm sure you've been through those wars in New Haven.
Yeah, I think what Elaine said is absolutely right. In the poll numbers that are showing up here, I think everybody else agrees with that. Because the general idea, developers actually like that in many cases. I mean, in some cases, it's clear-cut what needs to go on the property. You know, it's a old chemical industrial area. You're not going to put a hotel up. You're not going to put a community center up. But clearly, with the community having a general idea, really, really helps that developer, because they want a good developer will want to hear that and will actually be able to, if at all possible, and as Elaine said, it's got to be market-driven, but if at all possible, even if it's a mixed-use property in some cases, that way they could bring in elements of it. You know, they really want retail on the first floor. They need a pharmacy in the area. They need a food store. They need, you know, something that the neighborhood needs and wants. I've worked with lots of developers who, you know, out front are very open about asking what people want, and at the same time being honest that, you know, if it won't work, they'll be honest and come back and say, why not?
Yeah, my only comment, Amy, is to say that you definitely want to leave room for the real estate community's creativity, because they will add to that vision. They will come up with ideas that you just never would have thought of necessarily on your own. Even if you hire the best architects and reuse planners and whatever, the development community is extremely creative. And if you create a framework, they'll paint you, you know, they can paint you, you know, Picasso. So, but we have this case study that Elaine is going to walk you through. It's a real case study. We want you to see how different developers look at stuff, and then we'll have time for some more questions before we end.
Great. So we're back at our 120-acre industrial site. We're going to go through the actual results of an expression of interest process. We're not going to show all the results, but we're going to compare a little bit about some of the offers that were received on the property. So again, 120-acre, heavy industrial manufacturing use. The plant was recently shut down, and it was located in an active multi-state market, meaning that it was located in an area where multiple states affected what the real estate market was doing. So what were the site opportunities? From a positive side, it was a large site. This market was dominated by small parcels, and so this fact that it was 120 acres, and even though only about 100 of them were actually usable because of deed restrictions, it still stood out in the market. It was industrial zoned. In this particular area, there were restrictions on expanding industrial zoning. So you couldn't go in and get a zone change on another property, on a green field. So this was attractive to an industrial market. It had on-site freight rail, waterfront road location, and excellent highway. All of those things can be attractive to different types of uses, some more than others. It also had excellent utilities and infrastructure. Why is this important? Utilities and infrastructure are a significant expense in the construction phase. And the fact that it had just recently shut down and these utilities were fully operational and had good capacity was really a significant asset for the property. It was an active RCRA site, and it had an active MPDES permit, and that MPDES permit had the potential to be transferred. So that was attractive to some of the entities that expressed interest in the property. So what were some of the constraints that were identified by the developers? I mean, had moderate to steep site topography. It was sloping towards the river. There were obsolete buildings and structures. If all of them were removed, it would cost about $6 million to do the demolition. There was difficulty getting land use approvals. It's very time-consuming, and there's multiple layers of land use approvals, especially because of the fact it's next to a river and has some floodplain designation on it. Closure of the RCRA permit was required. CMS had been submitted, but we didn't have an approved CMS, and closure wasn't complete. And there were some previously closed impoundments on the site we talked about already that had land use restrictions that had to be considered. And under the CMS, there was expectation for ongoing groundwater monitoring requirements. So here we have one property, all those assets, all those constraints. Two interested developers I'm going to talk about. We actually had about five interested developers. These two developers have very different approaches. The developer number one was a joint venture between an experienced developer and an environmental remediation company. One of the partners also operated a soil recycling facility. Therefore, they want properties with uneven topography that requires large quantities of fill. That was a real benefit to them, and so the fact that it was uneven topography was a real asset as far as they were concerned. The existing rail and the roadway access, with their quality and their capacity, was also important to this developer. They had a need under their vision for large areas of impervious surfaces, so they were not as concerned about land use restrictions or the ongoing requirements for monitoring. They could work around that, and they thought that the economic and regulatory climate was fairly attractive for what they needed. They were proposing a 1 million square foot fulfillment and distribution center, one very large building, continuing to use the rails, and obviously access to the highway was key for this type of use. Developer number two was a joint venture between a developer and an environmental remediation company and a liquefied natural gas producer. The environmental contractor makes their money on site decommissioning and scrap metal recycling. That's a big portion of their revenue stream. So they looked at, first off, the fact that it was previously a heavy industrial use was really attractive because they expected minimal opposition to this reuse vision. It already had been a highly heavy manufacturing. They weren't expecting a lot of pushback. The recent shutdown provided the opportunity to generate income from decommissioning. They needed the rail and the roadway access in order to serve the generating plant. And the waterfront location provided opportunities for barge for the liquefied natural gas producer. All of this was attractive to this developer. Now let's talk a little bit about the constraints. How developer number one, again, they're looking at 1 million square feet fulfillment and distribution center. Market demand for this distribution center required that it be developed and constructed and operational in 18 to 24 months. It was a really quick time to get this up and operational. So they saw that the time frame for getting entitlements and getting through the regulatory process was a greatest risk. Regulatory from the standpoint of the fact that they had floodplain approvals, riverfront approvals, and also looking at the issue of the CMS and getting that approved and knowing that they could transfer the property. Developer number two, their constraints were primarily related to its waterfront proximity. There's a perception of flooding, even though the floodplain was very small, and they felt that the perception of flooding was a risk to them getting their financing and their insurance for this sort of development. They also wanted to make sure that they had all of their entitlements in place, including getting EPA approvals before they started this work, even before they started doing some of the demolition. They wanted to make sure that everything was in place, and that presented a time constraint. The market opportunity for the power plant and data center, specifically the data center portion of this work, was a very small sensitive window. So let's talk about the contract that was negotiated. Developer number one came to this project with no contingencies. They were willing to sign on the dotted line immediately. Developer number two, the deal was contingent upon getting EPA and state approvals, not only for the cleanup, but also for the development itself, and given the fact that this was going to involve power generation, that could take some time. They also needed to get confirmation of the electric interconnection for the and fuel supply in order to do the power generation and the data center both, and getting electric interconnection approvals is not a fast process. And so they wanted to make this contingent on the contract. So they were not willing to sign the contract until they knew all of that was in place.
Elaine, we just put up the poll just to see what people thought as you were going through everything, like which developer is poised to make a better deal.
Okay. So now I'm going to tell you what the offers were, and you can see if maybe this changes a little bit. So offer number one, developer number one came in with the offer to acquire the property after all decommissioning and demolition was completed. They offered to assume all remaining environmental liabilities, including the post-closure and care plan. They would take care of anything that was required as far as the CMS. They were offering $15 million for the property. They asked for 60 days of due diligence, and they would close using cash. The second developer was offering to purchase the property as is. The owner did not have to do any of the demolition or decommissioning. and they would assume all remaining environmental liabilities once the CMS was approved and they knew exactly what that approval was. They didn't want to do the negotiations for getting CMS approval. They would assume the post-closure care plan. They offered $13 million. They needed 30 days of preliminary due diligence, and that was to determine whether or not the natural gas and other fuel sources and the electric grid could handle it, but then they wanted 150 days to get their entitlements in place because, again, this deal was contingent upon all their entitlements. So how does it really work out? Which is the better deal when you look at it from the owner's perspective? So developer number one was offering $15 million cash. The company would have to spend $5 million in planned expenses. Not everything had to be demolished of their original budget. They would have $10 million in a cash closing, no contingencies. It just wouldn't occur until the owner had completed their demolition. Minimal risk that this deal was going to go through. Developer number two was going to give $13 million in cash, but they were also going to do the demolition and metal recycling. Therefore, that was saving the owner $5 million over the developer number one offer. So actually, it was $18 million in the owner's pocket by comparison to the $10 million. They did not have their financing final. They did need to get financing in order to make this happen. They also were contingent upon all receiving their entitlements, and they were asking to wait 180 days. So this particular deal was considered high risk, moderate to high risk. It was a better deal financially. It was a better deal time-wise for the owner, it was a better deal financially for the owner, but it was not a better deal time-wise for the owner, and there was a lot of risk there as to whether or not the deal would ever go through. So based upon that, the question is, which deal did the owner take? And the answer is actually neither one of them. There was a third deal that was a little bit different. But I wanted you to look at these two because you can see how the developers were looking to make their money and how they were willing to look at risk and where their risks were. And in reality, the environmental weren't the real risks to these two developers. It was getting the approvals for the developments that they were proposing that presented some of the greater risks to them. And so with that, we're going to move on to talking about questions and our upcoming events. Mike, anything else you want to add to our case study?
No. You'll have to call us offline if you want to know really what happened, because there is some degree of confidentiality with the client that did this, et cetera, et cetera. So, but we might tell you, or we'll see you at the workshop. We can talk about it then. But, they were good offers, and there were choices. But I think the point today is just that, there are many factors that go into these kinds of decisions, and they're not easy. They're complex. And, it really is about all the aspects of a site and a redevelopment that make, that make the deciding factors.
So, Mike and Elaine, this is Amy, and I'm just wondering if we could suspend reality for a minute, and let's just say there were just the two deals that you went through, the two developers. Which of those two, because I think everyone's dying to know, which of those two offers would have been better for the owner?
Good, Amy.
Yeah, the owner actually seriously considered developer number one's offer. It was fairly quick. They had already planned on investing the money for demolition anyway and decommissioning. They expected that they had to do that. So they were a little surprised that there were players in the market that wanted to do the demolition. We had encouraged them to do this expression of interest process before they started demolition because we knew that there were entities that might be interested. They learned that through this process, but they would have definitely accepted developer number one's offer before developer number two. They felt there was too much risk that they developer number two either would not get their entitlements or something would change during that contingency period, and they didn't want to lose developer number one. They wanted to move forward.
And the other thing that was a big factor for this entity was that they had shut down this facility and lost, you know, a number of jobs. Some jobs were transferred, but there were, you know, there was an impact to the local economy. And developer number one was talking about a lot of jobs. You know, there could have been, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 jobs. In new jobs in that facility, and that was important to them. You know, that was important that they try to meet that commitment. They had a very active CAP. You know, they had a lot of good relationships that they'd established over the years, and so that was part of the equation too.
Thank you very much for demystifying that. So it sounds like, you know, take the sure thing. Again, minimize your risk. That's a very attractive thing and for developers. Okay. We had a few more questions come in, and then we can, like, at the end jump to what happens next. One question that folks had, which I thought was really interesting, the question was, how do you typically screen developers? Do you use or look at previous success or failure rates? And so I'm assuming that this is from the perspective of, you know, a community, state, or tribe who is actually might be involved in, you know, selecting the developer. What are some things to look at?
Yeah, that's true, Amy. That it's likely the community and maybe, you know, EPA's, you know, has some involvement. But, you know, if the agency does meet with a developer, you know, I don't think it's unimportant that you ask questions about who they are. The one thing about the real estate world is that it's porous. Anybody can say they're a developer, and part of what we're trying to do is say that's not true. And if they don't show up with money, if they don't have resources, if they don't have a track record, you know, if they don't own property, if they're not well thought of in a community, you know, they're to be concerned about, right? And I would even suggest that there are companies active today in the brownfields world who say they'll guarantee things, that offer all kinds of promises, and you know, they're questionable. I mean, devil's in the details. You know, guarantee me that you're going to get that remediation done. Guarantee me that you're going to do that O&M. And so I do think track record is very important. Reputation in the community is very important. Our clients will ask for financial information. And if they say they're going to build something, we want to know where that money's coming from. So send us a letter from the private equity investor that's going to pay $50 million. To build X, Y, or Z, or the bank, or whatever the case may be. So all of that's very important, and you can never do enough due diligence. We have a guy in New York who you'll meet next week, Neil, or next next webinar, May 30th. I keep thinking we're doing this once a week, but May 30th. Neil Pariser, who literally had a lot to do with the rebuilding of the South Bronx. And one of the things Neil does for us now, having retired from that and having dealt with every kind of developer you can imagine, is he does due diligence for us. So he goes and looks in the court records. He goes and does a DMB on them. And, you know, he checks people out. He finds out what they did there in their last lifetime, you know, because we have to represent to our clients that this is somebody you can trust, and that's not always easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is Tony. I think one other municipality I worked for, we did a lot of ad hoc committees for city-owned land or sometimes state-owned land that we're trying to develop, and we would put an RFI out for developers, and we'd get some responses back, put together a committee. In some cases, we would formally score the development sort of response that came back and the developers themselves. And a lot of it, again, was based on experience and similar projects and do they have financing. Some of it was a informal process where we didn't actually want to put numbers to it, but we sort of did and talked about it through consensus. And I think that often is a helpful way, in particularly including deciding who sits on that committee to decide. And in a public sense, you often want, even though some of the proposals, especially the finance material, may be confidential, you do want sort of a mix on that. You want people from the banking industry, finance. You want people from the community, especially where the property is, to be involved in that process. And I think it helps sometimes doing that rather than keeping it a small internal staff sort of situation.
Thanks so much for those thoughts. Elaine, we had just a couple of questions come in about the case study that I wanted to address before we talk about next steps. Okay. Two quick questions were, one is, what is RCRA CMS? And then, so I'll let you answer that really quickly.
Sure. So under the CMS is the Corrective Measures Study, which is essentially the evaluation and the feasibility study under RCRA Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That is the program under which, under EPA, that the property was regulated. The CMS is essentially the last document to be submitted that would determine what the proposed remedy would be. So getting approval of the owner's proposed remedy from EPA and knowing that EPA concurs with that or knowing any changes that EPA may be requiring is something that is important to entities that are taking on the liabilities and the assuming the contamination for a property.
Okay, great. Thank you. That was for all our non-RCRA colleagues on the line. So then another question came in about the two scenarios that you went through, saying that both developers were going to acquire liability and with RCRA continuing to be involved. What else was going on? Was there a state voluntary cleanup or a brownfields program involvement piece to this?
Yeah, in these two, in this situation, these two developers were planning on doing the environmental themselves. If you remember, they each had environmental parties as part of their joint venture partnerships, and so they intended to do it themselves. And they were looking at the offer price. Our client did not ask for a particular price for the property. They built into their offer price the cost of doing the remediation themselves. So in this particular case, there was not a state voluntary cleanup program to operate or to transfer the site into, if you will. It had to get the RCRA closure process through EPA.
State was very involved, though. State was, you know,
oh, they were definitely
and EPA
weighing in.
Working together, yeah. Et cetera.
Absolutely. They were definitely weighing in and part of the process, but it wasn't a voluntary program that we could move the site into. The teams looked at the environmental work as something that they could do less expensive than perhaps the property owner had budgeted, and so they look at it when they make an offer on a property that they can come in substantially below what they believe the estimated costs would be. And CMS documents, just like under Superfund, if you have a feasibility study or a focused feasibility study, you've got cost estimates in there. Even though the CMS was not approved yet, the owner did share the study with the interested parties under confidentiality, and so they knew what the estimated costs were to do some of this work, and I'm sure that they both figured out that owning environmental firms, they could do it less expensive than what was being budgeted, and they factored that into their offer for the land.
Thank you. So we are almost at our time, and before everybody leaves, I want to thank our instructors for sharing a lot of really useful information with us and giving us a great overview of the process, walking us through the case study and giving us lots to think about for, you know, how developers look at this process, which is quite different than how EPA approaches these properties. So thank you very much. So this was our first webinar. There's two more webinars coming up, one at the end of the month. The focus is on market analyses, so you're going to learn much more about feasibility and how the market plays into site reuse feasibility. It's critical. And then on June 5th, real estate finance basics. Basically, how do you pay for this? So those are the webinars, and then like I talked about at the very beginning, we have a half-day workshop. We're going to offer it four times in the locations that you see here on the slide. And the June 28th one is the one we're going to live stream. Mm. So if your location is interested, your office, if you're working with colleagues in your state or tribe, in your region, we have points of contact identified who are going to set this up and for you so that you can participate from a remote location while the workshop is happening in Philly. And again, it's group exercise work, case studies, not a lot of instruction, but group work together, figuring out, can we make this deal go? Yeah. Really exciting. Now, last thing on this, please make sure that you register your participation today by going into CLUIN and filling out the feedback form. That's the way that we'll be able to track your participation. Even if you participated in a group, give us some feedback. Let us know you were here, and then we can track it if you, especially if you want to do the whole program and get your certificate at the end. Are there any last words from Abe?
No. Thank you all for participating, and we hope to see you again at the May 30th and June 5th webinars and at the workshops. And I'd just like to reiterate, please fill out the feedback form. That is how we will document your attendance, and you can get to it right now by clicking on that